5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to The New Next, the podcast where tomorrow is today and the future is now. I'm your host, Matthew Jensen, and together we'll embark on a journey through the evolving landscapes of technology, innovation, and the current events shaping our world.
So there's some pretty interesting new news on nuclear fuels. As you know, over the last years, nuclear as a power source to basically power the energy transition has become more of a commonly looked at solution to provide the level of energy that we need to really power a country like the U.S. There's been a lot of movement in here, but there's two stories that came out today, April 29th, from Bloomberg that I think are pretty important. First off, the Biden administration is considering an executive order to ban Russian imports of enriched uranium after congressional efforts to ban this stall. Why this matters is because Russia produces 5% of the global uranium production. On top of that, there's other countries like Uzbekistan, 7%, and then Kazakhstan that produces 46%, that I believe have close ties to Russia. Canada produces 10%, Namibia produces 12%, Australia 9%, and U.S. has a very, very small, I think below 1%, of total production. So it does mean a big thing, but it's been interesting because the DOE has really pushed rules and, you know, potentially funding mechanisms to build out domestic uranium supply for advanced nuclear reactors. So the DOE announced steps on January 9th of this year to really support basically enriched uranium supply to really power these small modular reactors that I believe we talked about on this podcast maybe 2 years ago. It's pretty... pretty an important thing. And as we've talked about on this podcast before, the U.S. is filled with these critical minerals. For instance, the Woodford Shale that runs through areas like Oklahoma does have uranium in the rock that they cut through. So not only are they producing oil, but you have the potential using, you know, as we've talked about this podcast too, traditional oil and gas methods to drill out rock where uranium can be extracted. And it's kind of an interesting thing. Like Wyoming, for instance, has really focused on putting in place mechanisms to rebuild their domestic supply in that state. One of the things that we have issues with is, I think perhaps the biggest deposit in the United States is basically right outside the Grand Canyon. So there are large deposits, but the thick of it and where the really high grade uranium deposits are within these national park boundaries. There are still functioning mines right outside of the Grand Canyon, for instance, But it's, there has to be really, I think, more of this internal mechanism to really stimulate the domestic industry. And some of this might be according to some of the steps that they've taken previously through the DOE and some of the other mechanisms, but funding that helps de-risk these projects and also essentially permitting reform, there has to be some sort of flexibility when it comes to getting these deposits, these production things jumped off the ground, because with a lot of the mining in the US, you always run the risk when the financiers are looking at funding these projects is what's the return viability. And when you add in a substantial risk premium to the financing that, hey, we might go through the permitting process here for, you know, 8 to 10 years, 12 years to get a mine off the ground, and it essentially be not allowed because of federal regulations. And it's it's kind of like there's this push-pull on the environmental stuff. And you can't have everything. There's no like perfect plan, but the importance to have flexibility on this complicated process to accelerate these permitting potentials is a big deal. So like I said before, mentioning some of the oil and gas methods that they've used traditionally produce oil and gas, where you're also putting essentially compounds down in the well that help solidify and stabilize the surrounding rock so that it it basically stays in a general structure and doesn't necessarily cave in. There's also the ability to use leaching methods and similar methods like they do with fracking, where you put pressurized leaching compounds down there that helps dissolve rocks, release minerals, and then you can take, whether it be the cuttings from the well or essentially the leach brine, where it includes dissolved minerals to the surface and process it on the surface, separate the minerals that you want to extract, whether that be things like uranium, nickel, etc. Basically produce these and process them on the surface, or take them to a processing plant in terms of the cuttings to release these materials. If you're able to go that route, then you can typically use the traditional oil and gas permitting process, which is a accelerated version of these typical mine processes that take, you know, 8 to 12 years, a minimum. And most of that is going through regulatory stuff, poking a lot of holes in the ground to see where you have high density deposits. And, you know, me, like if you're going to poke a hole in the ground, you might as well produce the oil and natural gas and also eventually use these depleted wells to stimulate and produce the minerals out of them too. Part of the advantage that you have is because you already have the produced compounds, the data on the water, the data on the core samples down in the wells. So you know the percentage of minerals that are already existing there. And you have a pretty good de-risked, albeit a smaller potential from one well than doing a giant mine, but you don't have to dig up the entire surface, dig these giant pits, and then process it. So I hope that as we produce more of these critically important minerals in the U.S., it goes to this lower intervention strategy, where I'm kind of looking at this as a reusing of existing assets that are already there, that have produced one thing once, and now you can use it to produce another. So there's also the Biden-Harris administration earlier this month took action to secure the nuclear fuel supply chain and equip revitalized domestic nuclear industry for the future, according to energy.gov. And this is a this is also related to this. We talked about how Russia has about 5% of the global supply chain capacity, but they also have 44% of the global uranium enriched surfaces and provide 20 to 30% of the rich uranium product used in the US and Europe. So if we're really going to look at transitioning Russia out of the supply chain on this, we need to build the domestic processing capacity too. So it's not just production. You eventually have to take it somewhere and enrich it so that it could be used in the process of as nuclear fuel for generating these power plants. So it's, I mean, this is an important thing. As we can continue to see this dislocation between the West and the East, between the US, Europe, and Western aligned countries, away from China and Russia, particularly, this opens up a lot of questions about where are we going to get these critical material, critical mineral supplies from, because, you know, on an overall sense, these are the two places that really control the processing capacity. As we said, with here, 44% of global uranium enrichment in Russia, China dominates the processing capacity for critical minerals. They don't have tons themselves, but what they do is they have arrangements with, you know, African countries, stuff like that. They mine it. Cobalt's a good example. They put it on ships, and then they ship it across the world to China, where it's processed and then used in their domestic market, and also shipped globally. So this is a big deal, and it's important, I think, that the Biden administration has notice this on the uranium side and is taking steps to do it. Nuclear energy does have a lot of bipartisan appeal right now as a fuel for the future, especially with these small modular reactors. The first, which I believe is being built in Wyoming in the U.S., between a company like funded mostly between Warren Buffett and Bill Gates. But building these smaller nuclear power plants to supply our cities with energy, it's an important deal, especially when there has been a lot of inroads to reduce hydropower, which is incredibly efficient. But there's been a lot of legal wrangling around pulling these out to restore, for instance, salmon spawning habitats. So that's a big deal on the Russian import ban and the mechanisms around that to really make sure that at least in the US, we start stimulating and really focusing on how we can both increase our capacity to increase domestic uranium production, both for the US and for allies in Europe, but that also we can create a stimulation in the processing capacity here in the US so that we can actually enrich the uranium here, whether it's mined here or mined somewhere else, and then use this as a strategic advantage for our Western countries in supporting our independence from these countries, Russia and China, especially that we're decoupling with. There's also another Bloomberg story that Jigar Shah, who's the director of the U.S. Energy Department's Loan Programs Office, told Bloomberg in an interview that they're looking at increasing loans that could provide currently shuttered power plants in the U.S. the capital that they need to be turned back on. There was a lot of push to shut down some of these, and this included a map, but there's a lot of plants, three in California and a lot spread over the northern Midwest and the Northeast, that are planned to be and scheduled to be decommissioned. So it's important, I think, with with our increasing energy demand, especially from hogs like data centers, which, you know, AI is really stimulating. The AI data centers have really amped up both the need for these data centers to process all the queries and models going through them, but also the need to have basically stable capacity that's there when you need it. And the thing is, you know, solar and wind just don't do it, and they don't do it at the scale and the efficiency that nuclear and even natural gas provide. So, you know, with the amount of rich uranium the size of a cup, you can produce quite an amount of energy from it. So I think this is a big step in providing stable and reliable energy on demand. And it's good to see, you know, people like Jigar Shah that are actually involved in the financing of this from a government level, really focused on this. It's important, and this is a big month of movement in terms of the Biden administration and the government entities all overall, the DOE and the Department of Energy, and the kind of expression of the political will to really do something about this. So, yeah, it's very interesting. You know, these are topics that we've discussed a lot on this podcast over the past couple of years, and it's important that they do this. If you're going to outlaw uranium, basically almost 50% of the enriched uranium from importing that in the U.S., I haven't looked at Europe. I assume that they're looking at similar policies. It has to come from somewhere else. And in the United States, we're really lucky to have the amount of resources that we have that can be usable to create stability in that, both in oil and natural gas, which are already, you know, have a built out industry. But as energy consumption continues to rise, you're either going to have to see productions increase and some of these alternatives increase for, you know, nuclear generation capacity, where you're going to see basically the price of energy skyrocket. So it's really a supply demand issue. It's an economic issue. And this is a good way to approach, albeit way too late, but a good way to approach really increasing our domestic capacity in a way that both benefits our own economy, but those of our partners and our ability to use our commodities, which we're lucky to have here in the United States, as a way that we can influence our partnership capabilities over the globe, and also our continued influence as our stated goals to be a beacon of democracy and support democracy and freedom throughout the world. So it's exciting. You know, there's a lot of people that do not like a lot of the energy rhetoric that has gone on from this White House, but with everything, there's good and bad. And it's important to acknowledge the steps that they're taking that are important and will have tangible effects on our ability to provide safe, affordable energy, and also the capacity in the market, both for our friends and for ourselves. So exciting times.
And that wraps up another episode here at The New Next, where the future isn't just something we predict, it's something we're creating together. But the conversation doesn't end here. We want to hear your thoughts, your ideas, and your visions for what comes next. Head over to MatthewADJensen.com to share your feedback on today's episode. Your insights not only fuel our discussion, but also help shape future episodes of The New Next. And while you're there, take a moment to explore how Matthew Jensen can help guide you through the intricate world of strategy and digital transformation. Whether you're looking to innovate, transform, or just stay ahead of the curve, let us help turn your challenges into opportunities. Before you move on to your next podcast or dive back into your day, take a moment to rate us. Your ratings help us reach more like-minded innovators and thinkers, expanding our community of future makers. Whether you're a tech enthusiast, a forward thinker, or just curious about the world's next chapter, thank you for joining us on this journey. Remember, the future isn't just something to be predicted. It's something we are actively shaping with every discussion, every idea, and every action. Until next time, keep pushing the boundaries of what's possible. Let's explore the future together. This is The New Next.